Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Art of Tracking radio show. Tracking is still alive and well. Join us as we interview master trackers from around the world. We'll hear their stories, their secrets. So tune in and enjoy all you hear. Welcome.
Welcome to the Art of Tracking Radio, episode 2 of Trail Nuggets, Big Meanings from Tiny Marks.
What's this mean?
Did the wind change direction?
What's this mark? Smell that?
Whose muddy footprints are these?
I see dog hair on the couch.
Did you hear that?
What's this mark?
When?
Who left these crumbs?
What's this mean?
Did the wind pick up?
Why do we have
ants? Is the leaf turning brown?
You
What's
feel
this
that?
Mark?
Are the clouds changing?
And now a story on nature literacy by Michael Douglas from Maine Primitive Skills School.
In the beginning, following footprints was a mystery, and it was only done during the wintertime. When I was growing up in the Pine Barrens, there were cottontails everywhere, these small little rabbit tracks brought me through the thickest, most unexplored parts of the backyard, which opened up to this vast area of pitch pines and scrub oak, tall cedar trees. I'd get lost in there for days sometimes. After a while, especially after coming back from the Marine Corps, I noticed that not everybody had that same experience. And only now do I fully understand that tracking is the pinnacle of nature literacy. It is the expression of reading the landscape as if it were a novel. And each time I go out, it's not my peers, it's not the internal mechanisms going on inside of me, it's the living entities and their tracks that lead me to the greatest mysteries and discoveries. I want to take you to one in particular story that was laid out for me by a deer. I have this propensity, I call it my New Jersey mind, to move too quickly, whether it's day-to-day existence, having conversations, or even tracking. And as a result, one of my weaknesses is jumping to conclusions. And it wasn't until I had some tools, thanks to Dan Gardoki and the people at White Pines, Tom Brown, of course, and Paul Resendez, and all of the people that I've tracked with who have sayings like, correlation is not equal causation, and you better rule out the animal that you think it is. Why isn't it a coyote? Why isn't it a porcupine? In doing that, you can keep your logical mind in check. So in this one particular tracking episode, I had just come off of a fantastic display of self-humiliation when in the morning I was watching deer feeding at the cedar at the end of the driveway, and during the afternoon I had a day program where I immediately jumped into the drainage ditch where I knew the deer were that morning, pointed to the first track I saw, and said, "Look, a deer track." And I looked up, and as the students were scratching their heads and looking puzzled at me and each other, I finally looked down at this perfectly placed canine track. More humiliating, it was a domestic dog. And it was a domestic dog that was on a leash and had jumped down into that drainage ditch and back up the other side to take a big steamy dump right at the base of the very same cedar trees that I watched the deer nibbling that morning. And so here I was, after the class, feeling exasperated, a little ashamed of myself, and determined to slow down. And there again I found the deer tracks, this time across the street leading into the wildlife refuge. And I promised myself that I would spend at least 2 minutes per step between me tracking the tracks and moving with a fox walk, barefoot. And it didn't take long before I lost myself in thoughtlessness, sustained thoughtlessness, and being completely plugged into the direction of the wind, the birds as they filled closer in toward me, the stages of growth of the important edible medicinal plants. And after an hour and a half, 2 hours, I don't know, I was so immersed in timelessness that I lost track of it. There was this tan rock in the middle of the trail. And passively, in a daydreamy state, I started marveling at the unique texture of that rock when suddenly it grew a shoulder and an eye and an ear. And to my astonishment, the deer that I had been tracking, the deer that I had no thoughts about, was laying there not 20 yards from me. So I just want to put out there that while it looks like a bunch of random dots in the ground, there's something calling to all of us that takes us not only deeper into a state of literacy about the world around us, but also a greater understanding of our own internal tracking, because neither of them are mutually exclusive. Both of them are intimately related. It is, after all, a mutually beneficial symbiotic relationship between the Earth and those who track it. Thank you.
Lines in the Sand by Garth. I remember finding some mystery lines out on Savi Island, out on the beach. I was walking the beach, which was pretty common for me to do. And there was, out in the middle of the beach, there was five parallel lines. All the lines were about 6 inches long, and they're about an inch apart. Just parallel lines out on the beach. Nothing else around. Let's see, this was back in 2012, the beginning of October. I pondered these lines for a while, looking at them, wondering what in the heck could this be. There was nothing else around. So anyways, I walked down the beach a little bit more and found another set of lines. This time there was 4 lines. They're all parallel, a little bit longer, still about an inch apart, 8 feet down from the other set of lines. So this really had me confused. I didn't know what was going on, so I tried to look for some connection between this set of lines and the other set of lines that was 8 feet down the beach. Both these sets of lines were about 10 feet from the river's edge, the Columbia River. So I couldn't find any connection between those two, so I walked a little further down the beach, and about another 8 feet down the beach, there was another set of parallel lines, and I don't remember if it was 4 or 5 lines, but it was very similar to these other sets of lines that were an inch apart, all parallel, and it was also 10 feet from the water's edge. So this really had me pondering what in the world these were. So I continued walking down the beach a little bit more, and came to some great blue heron tracks. And the great blue heron tracks were landed, looked like it landed at the water's edge, walked up the beach a little bit, turned, and there where it turned, not only was there a scat, but there was also wing marks, like it had flapped its wings or something. It had wing tracks next to its tracks. And then I was like, uh-huh. The light went on above my head, and, you know, I was like, those look just like those marks on the sand. So then I went back to those parallel lines that I was finding, those mystery lines that were 8 feet apart, and came to the conclusion that those were great blue heron wing marks. As it was flying close to the beach enough that the downstroke of the wing was actually the feather tips were hitting the sand. So those were the feather tips, and every 8 feet it had a downbeat of its wing. So I thought that was really cool. Took pictures of all that stuff and then continued on walking down the beach and got past those tracks and the great blue heron tracks that had the wing marks next to it, passed that up, went further on down and found another set of great blue heron tracks. And this one had kind of a weird step to it. I don't know. It didn't look like just the regular walking great blue heron. There was something a little funky about it. And once again, there was wing marks next to the tracks. So this was, I was getting kind of excited because I don't see wing marks in the sand very often. So I thought this was pretty darn cool. And then, anyways, took some pictures, continued on down the beach. There at the far end of the island on the beach, I found a dead bird. Not a great blue heron, but it was a dead Canada goose or some kind of similar bird to a Canada goose. Just dead. I inspected that a little bit and couldn't find anything physically wrong with it. No injuries or anything that were apparent. But anyways, took a picture of that. And then that night when I was at home, I was watching the news, and on the news, they were mentioning a avian botulism outbreak at Smith and Bybee Lake, which is a lake in the Portland area, not far from where I was at. And it was a big warning because the water levels were so low and the water was getting really warm, the temperature, and this avian botulism was in full outbreak, and a lot of birds were suffering. And the light bulb just kind of went on again. It was like, oh, man, I bet you those wing marks that I was seeing are not, you know, they're not some cool sign for me or something. You know, it's like, no, that's a sign of a sick bird. That's the sign of a bird that's becoming paralyzed from avian botulism. So that night, all I wanted to do is get back out to Savi Island and investigate a little bit further, see if anything else showed up. But it was too late in the evening. So the next morning, I decided to head out there. I went to Savi Island, got out to the island, parked my rig, walked down to the beach. And as I was cresting over, coming down the beach, right there, at the water's edge was a dead great blue heron. And for me, that was enough confirmation that bird, that was a sick bird that I was seeing, a bird suffering from avian botulism. So, yeah, small little details in the sand can really, you know, if you investigate those, they could have something out of the normal. It could really mean something bigger in the big picture of the environment. I think that was a big lesson I took away from that one. And now for a story from Kim Cabrera with Bear Tracker's Den.
So the theme of this radio show, I'm told, is big results from little clues, I think, paraphrased. Anyway, what I wanted to talk about was an incident where I used sign rather than tracks and found something pretty fantastic. And this all happened back in 1989 when I was working at the Grand Canyon. And national parks are great places to work if you get the chance. Your time off is spent in these beautiful destinations, and you get to explore and get to know these places pretty well. So what happened was, this is my story of finding treasure at the Grand Canyon. And you might kind of wonder what sort of treasures could be found there. Well, one day I was wandering around, and what I was trying to do was go cross country to get to this overlook on the map, and I decided to, you know, cut through the forest and see what I could find there, as I was always interested in looking for tracks and signs of different animals, and there were a lot of wildlife species there to find tracks from. So I started making my way through the forest, and I ended up at this power line right away sort of thing where they had cleared the area to allow the power lines through the trees. And so I followed that for a ways, and then I got off that and went back into the forest. And what I found was one of those old trail markers. And if you've ever looked in the scout manuals, you probably have seen the trail markers, like the rock cairns and blazes on trees and saplings bent over in the direction of travel to indicate a trail. And so what I found was one of those trees, or at least I assumed it was one of those trees, because the tree itself went up straight for a couple feet, and then the trunk was bent over at a 90-degree angle, and it was, you know, there's 3 or 4 feet of trunk bent over, running parallel to the ground, and then it was bent again into an upright direction at another 90-degree angle. So this tree had this crook in it, perfectly straight edges, 90 degrees on each side. And so I thought, wow, that looks like one of those old trail markers that you see in the scout manual and stuff. So I went over there to investigate this tree. And as I'm looking around at the tree, I stepped at the base, and the ground made a different sound than it did as you're just walking through the forest. And so I kind of poked at the ground at the base of the tree, and I realized that there was something there. Something was buried at the base of this tree. And so I started digging it out and grabbed a stick and started to dig years and years of forest stuff out. And I dug down and I hit one of those old gas cans like you used to see on the back of Jeeps. The big 5-gallon metal gas cans. They used to be painted red, I think. And this one didn't have any paint on it because it had been buried for many years. And so I thought, oh, okay. And I pulled that out and set it aside because there was more stuff under it. And there was a bag there. Looked like it had been made out of vinyl, sort of a vinyl duffel bag. And it had an old logo on it. I think it was TWA or something like that. So I pulled that out, and it looked like it had stuff in it. But there were still more things buried in the hole. So I reached in, and I pulled out an old ammo can. And that was, I think, that was pretty much it. Oh, there was a water bottle or something in there, too. Not one of the modern drinking bottles, but more like something like a gallon bottle that you would have had water in. So I pulled all this stuff out, and I sat there on the forest floor looking at what I'd just found, and then I decided to open everything. And so I started with the bag because it was pretty much falling apart. There wasn't much left to it. It looked like it had been at one point wrapped in a plastic bag, like a plastic garbage bag or something, but there wasn't much left, so I couldn't tell what the material was that it had been wrapped in. And so I opened this bag, which pretty much fell apart in my hands. And inside I found a bunch of wool uniforms. And they look like the really old type of army uniforms that you see in Civil War type reenactments with the, you know, the little wooden buttons on them and made out of wool. So it's a historical material. It's not something more of a modern material. And, you know, I took a couple of those out and the seams were pretty much shot because they'd been buried for so many years. And so the thread was gone, and so they started to separate. And so I just kind of pawed through it to see what was in there, and it was just all uniforms in this bag. And so I set them aside, not wanting to damage them, in case this was an archaeological find. Well, recent archaeological. Anyway, so the next thing I opened up was the gas can, and it had a metal lid on it, and I took that off, and stuffed inside of it were a bunch of those web belts, the old army type belts, and I just kept pulling them out one after the other. There was a lot of them in there. I lost count after a while, and the whole gas can, the 5-gallon gas can, was full of old belts and things, and it looked like maybe pieces of old gloves or something. This stuff had been buried for a while. So then I turned to the ammo can, and the water container also had more belts in it, and it looked like maybe old socks, pieces of socks. They were pretty rotten. It does get snow there, so the climate really isn't conducive to cloth being buried for any long-term period under the ground. So the cloth things were not in very good shape. And then I opened up the ammo can, and inside the ammo can, I found a scale, one of those old school balance scales. And I pulled that out, and it had a full set of little brass weights with it, and the thing worked. I tried it out right there in the forest. I was kind of surprised that after having been buried, it wasn't all rusty and ruined, but it seemed to be in pretty good shape. It was in an ammo can, so it was probably fairly watertight, and it survived being buried fairly well. And the date on it, I think, was 1933. There was a manufacturing date on a, I think it was on the bottom, or maybe it was on the front. I don't remember. It was a long time ago. And so I said, wow, this is pretty cool. I mean, how did this stuff get here? And, you know, why was it buried at the base of this tree? And did the person that buried it bend the tree so that they would be able to find it at some point and come back to it? So it was a national park, so obviously I can't just haul these things out of there and take them home or anything, and I was working there. And so when you find things like that, you usually have to let the rangers know, because it might be an archaeological resource, even though it's more of a recent time period than something ancient history. But so I very carefully put everything back in the hole, and then I went to go find a ranger, and came back out with a ranger, and the ranger said, this is kind of cool. And his theory was that those things possibly belonged to the army, and that what had happened was, back in the 1950s, there was a airliner crash where two airliners collided over part of the canyon and crashed into the canyon. And apparently at that time, the army was there for many months helping clean up. And the ranger thought that possibly those uniforms and things had belonged to somebody at that time. And he couldn't come up with a theory as to why they'd been buried there, or, you know, what the deal was. He said that they'd been camped there for many months back in the 50s. And they didn't look like 1950s vintage to me, but, you know, I don't know. And so I gave the stuff over to the ranger, and he did whatever they do with it. It might be cataloged somewhere in some dusty warehouse, but it was pretty cool to find that stuff. It was really exciting to find treasure. It's not like your everyday thing to go walking around out in the woods and find something that is older than you are buried at the base of a tree. And so I think it's probably my best big results from little clue story, because the only clue I had that there was anything different there was the tree, and the fact that the tree was bent in such a way that it looked like it was a trail marker of some sort, like you would see in an old scout guide. So that was my fascinating story of finding treasure at the Grand Canyon. And since then, most of my treasures have been tracks that I find that are really neat or fantastic, or, you know, in really good shape. But, you know, beware of other things out there, because trackers tend to wander around in the woods, and people tend to hide things in the woods. And so who knows what treasure is out there buried at the base of some tree. So keep your eyes open when you're out there, not just looking for animal sign, but look for other clues as well. And you might be telling your own treasure hunt story sometime on Garth's radio show. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Trail Nuggets as trackers tell their stories. Special thanks to Michael Douglas with Maine Primitive Skills School, Kim Cabrera with Bear Trackers Animal Tracks Den, and to my parents for some of their sound effects. Thanks.